This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. The American Rescue Plan Act is hurtling toward final passage, but only a few percentage points, we're talking single digits, of its massive $1.9 trillion price tag is specifically geared toward addressing the pandemic. Most of it is instead a pre-existing Democratic Party wish list of increased spending on virtually every aspect of government, including significantly hiked unemployment benefits, even more money for schools, a gigantic child tax credit, and subsidies for Obamacare insurance policies that would phase out only at a household income of more than $580,000. This legislation, of course, comes on the heels of the $4 trillion in supposedly COVID-related spending passed last year. My guest today is Peter Suderman, features editor at Reason and the author of the magazine's newest cover story, which is titled Josh Hawley's Toxic Populism. That's a deep dive into one of the Republican Party's rising stars, and we talk about the Missouri senator's anti-libertarian platform while also taking the measure of the nearly $2 trillion of brand new spending passed in Congress along strict party lines that is about to be signed into law by President Joe Biden. Here is the Reason interview with Peter Suderman. Peter Suderman, thanks for talking.
Great to talk to you, Nick.
Okay, so let's get right to it. The American Recovery Act, $1.9 trillion in something. What's your capsule summary of the legislation and what it represents?
It's a grab bag of pre-existing Democratic policy priorities passed under the cover of emergency pandemic relief. And so Joe Biden came into office and there was a pandemic. And in some ways, there is an economic crisis, especially for younger, lower skilled workers making less than $50,000 a year, especially those who work in the hospitality, restaurant, service industry. Those folks are really hurting. And because of that, Democrats sort of said, hey, look, we've got the House, we've got the Senate, and we've got the presidency. Let's use that as an excuse to do all the things that we've ever wanted to do. Maybe not quite all of them, but quite a few of them. And so we have $1.9 trillion worth of Democratic policy priorities, many of which have little to nothing to do with the pandemic itself.
Yeah. Let's start with, what in it actually has to do with combating and ending the pandemic?
So there's about 1% of the funding goes directly to vaccines. Vaccines, by far the most important tool for combating and ending the pandemic. Only 1% of the funding is directly related to that. And then about 5% of the funding is related to other public health measures. And the rest of it is just sort of money for everyone, money for families with kids, money for state governments that haven't had the expected revenue shortfalls, money for unions. And so this is just a, I think of that scene, that incredible scene in Goodfellas where Henry Hill is walking into the Copacabana and, the camera tracks behind him and it's this famous tracking, sort of Steadicam tracking shot. But what it's showing you his world and it's showing you how he owns his world. And the way he does that is by giving every single person a handout. Yeah. And sometimes it's $20 and sometimes it's $100. And it's partly to impress the girl he's wooing at the time, right? So, but partly to sort of keep those people in his orbit. And there is something similar here. Right? Biden and Democrats in Congress are trying to woo and impress their own base. They're trying to say, hey, look, you got us power. We're going to use it. We're going to show you that we're rich, that we have, that we are rich in government power and the ability to spend. And so we are going to spend a lot of money on everything. And we're going to say that it's because of the pandemic.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is that we can blame this all on Lorraine Bracco.
No, we're going to blame it on Martin Scorsese, as is our traditional villain on these podcasts, Nick.
Yeah, that's true. Although I off topic, but I am starting to come around to his view on Marvel superhero movies. But
that's
it doesn't help me.
A whole additional podcast, which I'm happy to record, but.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that I like his movies anymore. It's just that I'm now getting to a point with movies where I am with professional sports. I only root against teams. I no longer root for them. To go back, though, to this American Recovery Act. So what we have is, I mean, it's kind of analogous to the Patriot Act, where, you know, the Patriot Act is able to be passed after 9/11, but almost everything in it had been around for decades and certainly for years. So now this is like, you know, the Kraken was awakened not for helping Donald Trump avoid impeachment. It was, you know, it's just to let government spend on everything. You know, what are the three biggest kind of provisions of it that really you think will be doing the most damage long term?
Sure. Let's go through a couple of them. So there's $68 billion for multi-employer pension plans. And maybe this isn't going to do the most damage long term, but it's notable just because of how little it actually has to do with the pandemic. These are private union pensions for freelancers, and they have managed their pension funds badly. Often investing too aggressively in order to make up for gaps, right? Their investment strategies don't make sense given the generally older nature of their members. This bailout was a Democratic policy priority long before anyone knew the word coronavirus. It just has absolutely nothing to do with COVID.
What are some of the names of the unions covered by this?
I actually do not have the names in front of me.
Okay.
But just it's construction. It's a lot of folks who work in Hollywood, right? It's, again, it's freelancers who kind of shift between different types of jobs and different employers throughout the year. Right. And these are, again, multi-employer pension funds, right? It's sort of the title explains it. But this is just notable because it's just pure handout to unions here, and it has absolutely nothing to do with stopping the coronavirus or even with sort of boosting the economy in a general sense. Another provision that's notable is $350 billion in aid to states. Now, this was a priority for Democrats all of last year after we passed the first round of coronavirus stimulus recovery relief bills. They kept saying, well, states need money. States need money because they're hurting. And it was true that last year, early in the year after the pandemic hit, there were projections showing that states would really face huge revenue losses. And they did during the financial crisis a little more than a decade ago. So Democrats were saying, look, in order to keep essential state services online, we've got to have a huge amount of money for states. But as it turns out, most states are actually doing basically fine. Revenues are down barely at all on average. And in some big states, particularly in California is looking at a $15 billion surplus. And yet the way this is written, California, a big blue state, is going to get money from this pile here. And this is sort of...
Where does California's surplus come from?
It's from their tax structure. And partly it's by taxing higher earners. And they've got California has an economy that is built in many ways on highly educated, highly efficient, right, sort of tech and entertainment world, people who make a lot of money. And California has decided to treat them as tax cattle in a lot of ways, which is one of the reasons you see the beginnings of an exodus from California to places like Texas and Florida that are more favorable tax environments for higher earners.
Okay, so we've got bailouts of multi-employer pensions.
Yeah, there are two other provisions that I really want to talk about here that are really notable. One is $34 billion over 2 years to boost Obamacare subsidies. So the way Obamacare was written was that if you were buying private insurance through the Obamacare marketplaces, you would get a subsidy that was a pretty good subsidy if you were relatively low income, and then an okay subsidy if you were up to about 400% of the poverty line, which today is about $106,000 for a household of four. But if you made just over that, say $114,000 in a household of four, then you were going to get nothing. And Obamacare plans are very expensive because they're highly regulated and required to cover a huge number of things. And so those plans were unaffordable for a lot of people who were just over the line. And Democrats have been trying to fix this problem that in some ways Obamacare helped create, For years. And so what they've done here is add $34 billion in additional subsidies, and they've lifted the cap on income. So the formula is somewhat complicated. It's based on the average price of a benchmark plan in your area. That's sort of a typical plan for your area. But what it means is that you, if you are a relatively, not relatively, a quite high earning household, say $350,000 in some cases, depending on where you live in the country, this is going to mean that that households with $350,000 in annual income are going to qualify for subsidies. And again, the excuse here is the coronavirus.
The economy is suffering.
It's true. Yeah. There are people who are suffering. That's absolutely right. But the people who are suffering are not households with $350,000 a year incomes.
So what's your fourth one?
The other one is the expanded child tax credit. Now, again, this is just for 1 year. And like the Obamacare subsidies, right, it's temporary. So that subsidy was 2 years. And the expanded child tax credit is now going to be a refundable payment of about $300 per child to parents, most parents in the country, right? And so it goes, it's a little less if the kids are over five. There is an income cap, but it phases out at $400,000 a year in annual income.
Right.
And so again, this is
1 year.
It's
$3,000. It's $3,000, right?
Sorry, it's $300 per month, right? Is the way it sort of works out.
Per month,
right?
Yes.
So it's, so again, this is okay. The idea here was, instead of paying people, you know, sort of instead of giving people money in their tax refund, instead of just sort of setting this up as something that you could sort of file and qualify for, the idea is to pay people throughout the year, right? And in some ways, it's there's a
that makes sense.
There's in some ways there's a core of a good idea here, which is that it's simpler and more straightforward. But it is. So this is 1 year, and the Obamacare subsidies are 2 years. But Democrats have made absolutely clear that they do not intend these temporary boosts to become to end after 1 year and 2 years.
Right.
They want to expand these and make them permanent forever. And so what they've done here is they've smuggled in effectively a new entitlement, a kind of UBI for parents. And along with that, an expansion of Obamacare, because they're going to run on this next year. They're going to probably, you know, I think in the case of the expanded child tax credit, it's likely to have been made permanent or at least extended for a couple of years before we get to the 2022 election. And so this is not just $1.9 trillion. This is a revolution in some ways in social spending. And this stuff becomes permanent, we're going to end up that this is going to end up costing us $3 trillion over 10 years rather than $1.9 trillion.
Right. I mean, it's great what you are saying with a straight face. And, you know, this is the world we live in. Like, this is not just $1.9 trillion, as if, you know, a decade ago, that would have made people's heads explode, because this is, you know, and obviously we're coming off of last year's record spending, record emergency spending, but this is a step change, isn't it, in how we are even thinking about government, how we are thinking about stimulus, how we are thinking about emergency appropriations.
Yeah. So I wrote a piece a week or two ago in which I argued that we are increasingly living under government by emergency. And I think that in many ways, it didn't quite start with 9/11, but it really kicked into high gear with 9/11. And you mentioned the way that 9/11 spurred the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, of the Transportation Security Agency, of all of this sort of security apparatus that was vaguely related to transportation security and, you know, stopping terrorists from using planes to kill thousands and thousands of Americans again, but only vaguely related, and in some cases, not really related at all. I mean, the DHS was, in theory, there was half of a good, maybe there was 10% of a good argument there, which was, hey, there's a whole bunch of bureaucracy and they don't talk to each other. And this was one of the problems that was diagnosed in the aftermath of 9/11, if you remember, right, was we have so much bureaucracy and they're really bad at coordinating the interagency is broken. And so what they did was create an entire new bureaucracy and a huge extra layer of bureaucracy on top of the old bureaucratic superstructure. And it didn't solve any of those problems. What it did was create a bunch of government jobs and a bunch of administrative, sort of messes, right? There have been stories for years about how like morale is super low in DHS, about how they still, you know, like it's just rife with administrative failures because it's the solution to bad bureaucracy isn't a whole lot more bureaucracy. But that's the kind of thing that we get every time we have one of these big national crises. I mean, when you just you also think about the financial crisis again, just to pull this off of COVID for a little bit, the financial crisis was a crisis of it was an economic crisis in which a lot of middle class normal people's homes values just suddenly dropped. A lot of people lost their jobs. So what was the very first thing that Congress did? Give a huge amount of money, probably unconstitutionally, to big banks.
Right.
And so it's just been this sort of procession over this last 20 years of grabbing emergency powers because there are real crises. These are not fake crises. The recession was real. 9/11 was not something that that government had no call to respond to in any way. But when it does respond, it responds badly. And it doesn't do things that are actually directly related to the problem. Instead, it just sort of passes a bunch of stuff that's already sort of been floating around in advance. And that's exactly what we're seeing here with COVID.
I think that you're totally onto something with the idea of, a perpetual state of emergency. And I think it's particularly worrying. I've talked about this in other contexts as well. The Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben, you know, who basically using the Nazi philosopher Carl Schmitt, who of course outlived the Nazi regime and is well regarded in certain circles, talked about how liberal democracies, constitutional democracies, their biggest weak point is the state of emergency that gets declared and allows the suspension of normal rules. Agamben is a good Foucauldian, and this is in the very much in the libertarian tradition of Foucault. When you have endless emergencies, you get to suspend the normal state of affairs and you do all sorts of things. And we've seen that, I mean, in the entire 21st century, because even before 9/11 with the tech bubble bursting, there were a series of, emergency interventions into the economy and whatnot, but it gets worse and worse. And I don't think it's going to end well, particularly for us. Do you run through the arguments of I don't think either of us believe in a Keynesian stimulus. And we went through this, this kind of debate and discussion during the financial crisis. You know, assuming there is a time and a place for a stimulus to help kind of right-size the economy or, get it back up, are we in that? And if not, why is it so appealing to so many people?
Let me say this. I think there was a better case last year around this time, March, April of last year, when the CARES Act was passed. And that's not to say that I think the CARES Act was in its form, structure, or scale a great idea. But in April of last year, we basically shut the economy down. Now, we can argue in retrospect, maybe we shouldn't have done that. I do think going back to what we knew at the time, it was very hard to tell what the right thing to do was, on April 10th of 2020. And so I'm willing to say we made some mistakes, some big mistakes, but in some ways they were understandable because we were in the middle of something that nobody knew what was going on. And so when the government comes in and says, as a result of an unprecedented public health emergency, hey, we're going to shut down huge portions of the economy, I think you can make at least a reasonable, I'm not quite sure how far I want to go and say I agree with it, but at least a reasonable case that when the government shuts your business down, they owe you something. When the government says we're building a highway through your property, and that's not your property anymore, that's no longer yours. We're just going to do that. You have no choice. Well, first of all, we ought to be skeptical when the government does that. But second of all, when they do, they've got to pay you. And so I think last year there was more of a clear case for doing something on the fiscal side. I'm not sure that what we did was the right thing. But I think there was a clearer case for relief measures at that point. But at this point, there's so much less of a case because, in part, because of the $4 trillion nearly that was spent last year, the economy is set to roar in the second half of this year. And that's not to say that Keynesian spending just works and is great, but it is to say that if you pump $4 trillion into the economy, you're going to get an effect. There's not going to be zero effect. It doesn't do nothing at all. And particularly the way we did it over the last year and the way where the Biden plan is going to continue doing this and sending checks to a lot of people. And so a bunch of that money is going to end up getting saved because a bunch of it's going to go to people who have stable incomes and who have not lost jobs and who have over the last year and maybe continuing months decided to pare back on household spending. But some of it's going to go into the economy. And so there is going to be some effect. I think there's just much less of a case certainly for doing a really big stimulus right now this year. And that, I think, is sort of one of the fundamental flaws of the Biden plan, is that they started out thinking, not even really thinking what specific things they wanted to do with a stimulus. They just wanted it to be really impressively big. And this dominated the debate for the first couple of weeks as this package was being put together, was the Biden team kept saying, hey, the main thing we want here is to go big. And they actually rejected a Republican plan put together by a handful of Republican senators that was quite big by any sort of historical standards. It was about $600 billion, a little more. And it was
it seems so small.
Right. And they said, their rejection of that wasn't even, this wouldn't do specific things that we need done. Their rejection was, well, that's just not big enough.
Yeah. Here is, and I recall the some of the discussions about the roughly $700 billion American Recovery Act, back in the stimulus during the Obama years. And it was kind of like that number was picked. There was a discussion of this and it came out. You know, they couldn't go with a trillion because that was too big and they didn't want to go too small. And they kind of, ended up around $700 billion, $800 billion because it seemed right. And, what do you make of the fact that here we are, a dozen years later or whatever, not even, and now $1.9 trillion is the new, it's like when Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile, it was seen as impossible. People would talk about how it was physically impossible for humans to run a 4-minute mile. It just couldn't be done. And then he did it. And then suddenly, within 10 years or 20 years, several seconds had been knocked off that. And the 4-minute mile was, of course, we could always do that. There seems to have been a breaking point here now. What explains that vast kind of magnitude shift in the amount that is now considered not just acceptable, but actually passable by Congress?
So that's a good question. Last year, I wrote a longish history of attempts to deal with the federal budget deficit, starting with the Reagan era and Graham Rudman Hollings, which is a super exciting sequestration plan that was put in place in the 1980s right. And didn't really work, like so many of these budget deficit plans. Right. It kind of sort of worked here and there for like a year or two, but in the long run, it didn't work. It did, in some ways, set the stage for the 90s era budget deficit reduction under, in particular, President Bill Clinton. But yeah. Part of the argument that I made in there is that as this has been happening, sort of over the last 30 or 40 years of the two parties bickering about the budget deficit, there's always been this sense, maybe not an agreement, a tacit agreement, right? That if we're gonna reduce the budget deficit, both parties have to share the pain, right? Because there's going to be like priorities on both sides are going to have to be eliminated somehow or another. Both sides are going to have to take a hit somehow or another. And what Republicans have done for at least the past 20 years since George W. Bush is every time they get an opportunity, they pass a deficit funded tax cut. Right. And so libertarians sometimes get mad at me when I talk about deficit funded tax cuts, but they pass tax cuts with no offsetting spending cuts. And if you pass a big tax reduction and you keep spending the same, right, then the deficit, which is simply the gap between tax revenues and spending grows. And what that has, and they've done so on the argument, more or less, that, oh, if you cut taxes, you don't actually lose revenue, which is just like, yes, there are times when this is true in certain ways, right? The supply side argument is not inherently false. If you have a 99% tax on bread, you're not going to get much bread sales. And if you reduce that tax to 40%, then you'll get more bread sales and more tax revenue out of it. That's totally true. But it doesn't necessarily work when the numbers are, you know, when it's a 20% tax on bread being reduced to 18%, right? The revenue right. optimizing number is not always, you know, is not always a lower one. But Republicans have just sort of taken a dumb version of this theory and used it to excuse tax cuts after tax cuts after tax cuts. And let me just say, even if you think those tax cuts are great, even if you think that they're the best policies that Republicans have given us over the last 20 years, part because they're about the only ones besides a bunch of big wars, Democrats don't. And what Democrats feel like is that's unfair. Republicans have this dumb theory that allows them to pass their priorities without taking any hits on the spending side. It means that Republicans can be the party of tax cuts and big spending. And that's true in a lot of ways. And so what Democrats have done in return is adopt a simplistic version of their own theory based in modern monetary theory. I don't want to say that Democrats are all hardcore Moslerite, you know, deep MMTers now. They're not. Most of them would not say I believe in MMT, but they are sort of inspired by the spirit of it. And the spirit of MMT is the deficit that just doesn't really matter, and we can spend a lot more and not worry about it. And so that spirit, again, not all of the details of the policy, or sort of not all of the ideas of the that way of thinking, has just influenced the average Democratic lawmaker as well as leadership. And so what we now have is a Democratic Party that just believes that the deficit doesn't really matter when it comes to spending, and you can just keep on spending. And we are seeing that in action now that they have control of all of Congress and the presidency.
What do you make of the fact, you know, I guess I'm still hopelessly naive or childish in that I like to think that politicians are somehow, how they act and what they prioritize is somehow connected to the, you know, the vox populi or something. And
the vox populi has always loved tax cuts and spending, right?
I mean, they want to pay, of course, now,
pay as
we've
little
getting,
as possible for as yeah. much in the way of government services as possible.
Yeah. No, and I mean, we've been getting that for the entire 21st century. I mean, it's just, you know, it's really kind of wonderful that we are getting exactly what we want. But more, you know, last fall, Gallup, which does these surveys annually or a couple times a year, found that 54% of Americans said they want government should be, they agreed with the statement that government should be doing more to address problems in society. That was up about 5 points for most, a good chunk of the 20th century. It was below 50% of people. I guess in 2012, there was the most recent high, which was 61% of people said, you know, government should be doing more. But, you know, it's on the rise again. It had gone back down. Even after 9/11, it was below 50% for a good part of time. What do you think is driving popular opinion to the idea that government should be doing more? And let me sharpen that point a little bit. This is after a year in which, obviously, we have the coronavirus. We have, you know, more than 500,000 people dead, which is staggering and is hard not only to conceptualize, but in many ways, it's hard to find. I mean, I've lived in two of the epicenters, and you just don't see it, really. You know, it's like, it's kind of out of sight, but it's, you know, it's there, it's huge, it's powerful. There's no question that the government screwed up on almost every level, either by acting arbitrarily or stupidly. You know, agencies like the FDA and the CDC, this is not a Republican or a Democratic issue. Governors, people like Gavin Newsom and Andrew Cuomo are finally starting to get hit in the head over how arbitrary and stupid their lockdown rules were, et cetera. But we've had, I guess what I'm saying, in the past year, we've both had this horrible disease and a demonstration project of how government is kind of dumb. And bad. It's almost like Munchausen by proxy. But, you know, so what do you think it explains the fact that, you know, people wanting government to do more to solve problems is on the rise.
You have often on the other podcast that we record together pointed to research suggesting that the worse government is at doing stuff, the more demand for government services there are. And I think that we are seeing that to some extent, certainly in the last year, but really over the last 20 years or so. And I think that in some ways, the failures of government are driving demand for more government. And so this is, to me, something that, libertarians need to reckon with, I think, more seriously in some ways, because what it suggests is that we want government to be good at the things that it does. And we want it to do not very many things, but when it does them, it should do them competently, efficiently, in ways that we're pleased to see them, Like, we should be happy to interact with the government
and accountable.
On the rare occasions when we do. And and this you know, and so that to me suggests that libertarians need to be invested not only in the project of tearing down dumb government things and bad government projects, of which there are many, but also in the project of figuring out how to make government do what it does better and more efficiently and more transparently, more open. I mean, this is, I think, just to me, you know, sort of one of the things is, it's not just that government is bad at doing stuff. It's that government is just not transparent and not truthful with people in so many ways. And we see that maybe most explicitly in the last couple of weeks with Andrew Cuomo and literally hiding, you know, nursing home deaths that were an outgrowth of his poor managerial decisions during the coronavirus. But we see this all the time, is that government just lies to people, or maybe more often declines to tell them the whole truth, gives them a shaded version of the truth. We certainly saw a lot of that under the Trump administration, but we're seeing it already under Biden. We saw it under President Obama. You know, if you like your plan, you can keep your plan.
And the most transparent administration.
I mean, like, you just, it was, I go back to that just in part because I covered it, but they made an explicit decision knowing that it would be not truthful to tell people that if you like your plan, you can keep your plan, because they thought, well, the lesson of the 1990s Clinton healthcare reform, which failed, was that if people feel like their plans are under threat, then this legislation will fail. And so they made a political calculation to lie to people. And that weirdly has the effect of making people both disillusioned with government and making them want government to step in and do more and fix the problems that it has created.
Yeah. And again, I think, you know, I am getting more and more, I think it's probably just because I'm getting older, more and more drawn to kind of history that looks at periods or eras. And I don't want to go, you know, totally Hegelian on this. But,
no,
you know,
this is the time to go totally Hegelian.
But yeah, I guess so, because I don't have to leave my house if I don't want to. You know, that there's spirits, different ages have spirits. And we are simultaneously, on the one hand, we are still in this, you know, incredible moment of dispersion and decentralization of knowledge and power. And, you know, we're doing this podcast, you know, a medium that didn't exist 25 years ago, where it was very difficult. And we're doing, you know, we have, I always like to joke, you know, that we have more, the poorest person in America has more computing power than all the pharaohs of Egypt. I mean, things are in some ways getting so much better and so much more futuristic than ever. But at the same time, we have this insane growth of the size and spending of government. I think part of it is the shift to a low trust society that you mentioned. It's also that we're not paying for it. So if you're getting a dollar's worth of government spending that you don't really want, but you're only paying 70 cents, you know, why not? You're kind of a schmuck, right? If you don't ask for more. But then on top of it is this, the lying, which again goes, you know, George W. Bush faked us into, you know, with the Iraq war, lied about how we were spending money, how we were paying for that war. Lied about surveillance. Obama lied about Obamacare and about surveillance. I still, you know, he's the luckiest guy in the world, I think, that he, you know, is sandwiched between George W. Bush and Donald Trump as president. Nobody is going to actually be, you know, kind of looking at what he did or didn't do with much detail for a very long time.
You mentioned tech there, and I think I just want to sort of interrupt just a moment to say something, because I think that's important. we have all this technology that is changing our lives and that is changing the way certainly we've all interacted over the last year, the way we've done business. At the same time, I do think there's a weird thing that's happened, even as technology has just become the the air in which we breathe, right? Like it's just, it's everywhere and it informs every interaction. At the same time, there's been a weird kind of a loss of hope and a loss of sense of vision for the future. People, we're getting back to an almost Middle Ages sensibility. And I'm a science fiction reader and I remember being struck by the notion as a very young boy who had just been steeped in science fiction for as long as I could remember, Star Trek, every week from the time I was 3 or 4 years old, that sort of thing. It was all, my family were all sci-fi nerds, that sci-fi was a relatively new concept, that 200 years earlier, science fiction didn't exist because people didn't think the future would be all that much different. And the further you go back in human history, that was the dominant mode of thinking, was that things will never really change. And when you start to think that way, as I think Americans have started to think that way, you stop thinking, well, things are going to be better. Things might get better. Instead, you start thinking, this is as good as they're ever going to get. And so what we need is a government to manage our kind of our complacency, our decline, our plateau better. And I think that loss of vision for the future really informs a lot of the demand for government and a lot of the policy debates, right? It underlies maybe not the specifics of a $68 billion union bailout, but that's the sort of thinking you get. That's the sort of policy you get in a world where people think, well, nothing is ever going to change for the better, and so
our best years are, it might be 5 years, it might be 10 years, or 25 years are behind us. So the appeal of Make America Great Again was that Donald Trump, bizarrely, was looking back to his youth, some period in the 70s or 80s, to say, that's what we should be again. Hillary Clinton had a version of that, too, when she was running, and these were both backward-looking old people who didn't particularly care for the shape of the future. And this, I was going to pivot into Josh Hawley, and I think this is and the Republican Party, this is a perfect time to do it, because Hawley is somebody who, first off, is like one of the greatest fakers, of all time, because he constantly is running against elites. And look at him, he's from the show me state of Missouri, but he is more elite. I mean, he has more elite credentials in his pinky than you and I, have times 100 in our entire bodies.
That's true, although some of his supporters or people who are at least interested in his project would say that, in fact, populism needs elite traitors, right? Traitors. Yeah. And they will welcome Hawley as a class traitor to the populist
cause. He's been to the elite campuses, so he knows just how screwed up it is. But He has a dark vision of technology. He wants to manage, quite literally as well as figuratively, he wants to manage the internet. He wants to manage social media. He wants to manage our fertility because he's a big fan of paying people to have kids or giving people who have kids more money. Discuss how what you have called a toxic populism, other people, I guess populism is always slightly authoritarian anyway, but what is his populism and how does it kind of reflect or refract a kind of left-wing populism that also seems to be ascendant at the current moment?
Yeah, so I think one way to think about him is through the lens of President Donald Trump, former President Trump, right? And Hawley is often seen as an avatar and pure creature of Trumpism. And that's not entirely wrong. He's certainly a creature of the Trump era. But I also think that he draws from a right-wing tradition that long predates Trump. And this is something that I tried to get into in the piece, because I think, again, I just think people sort of mistakenly view him as something that could only have existed under a president like Donald Trump, when in fact, he kind of comes from this tradition of middle-of-the-country social conservatives. They're very focused on values, not so much on economic policy right? They sort of think of themselves, they view themselves as traditionalists, people whose life goal or whose political project is to preserve what they view as traditional family life, which in many cases means banning, regulating, sort of eliminating unpleasant content, stuff that they don't like, most of which is produced by secular coastal media workers, right? By elites, because they view those people and their values and the things that they make as threats to their way of life. And so we used to talk about these people as values voters, right? That phrase values voters used to be a big part of the US political conversation. And it's kind of dropped out of our political lexicon, but Hawley comes out of that world. And he is just the new generation of values voter politician, except instead of focusing all of his wrath on Hollywood, on, you know, Mortal Kombat and Doom and Reservoir Dogs and gangsta rap, his family values culture war is entirely about big tech. Right. It's about Facebook and Twitter and whether they're shadow banning you and whether Google's algorithm is fair to, you know, this church or that right wing organization.
Diamond and steel.
And so much of it is
diamond and silk.
So much of it continues to be about, well, big tech is a threat to raising families and to raising children. Parents feel like they just have no control over the technology, how their technology is affecting their children, the tools that it's giving their children, the stuff that their children are being exposed to online on their phones. And so a lot of these types of voters that Hawley represents feel that big tech, like Hollywood before it, must be tamed by the government, by politics. And so I think in some ways, Hollywood is at heart, he's a populist. But an even better way of describing him, I think, is as a scold. And he just comes from a tradition of right-wing scolding, of moralistic politics. And I think it's notable that before he was a senator, Hawley was the attorney general of Missouri. And who was an attorney general of Missouri not too long before Josh Hawley? John Ashcroft, right? He, the attorney general under George W. Bush, who famously got really upset at a statue of Lady Justice that exposed, I don't even know if it was an actual bare breast, but it was something bare breast like, and he had to use some local curtains or something to cover
breast.
All of it for a press conference. And just, that Hawley really comes out of that kind of politics nearly as much as he comes out of the sort of Trump era populist aggressive, fight politics. But what he's done is reapply that sort of thinking that used to go to, like I said, rap music and video games and R-rated movies, and he's now applying it to social media and big tech.
How influential he obviously, and you make you document this well, he wants to be the future of the Republican Party. Whether he's going to be running for president or whatever, it's kind of besides the point. He's vying in a way that a decade ago it looked like, the Republican Party might become like Rand Paul. It might go in a what was then seen, I think, legitimately as a kind of libertarian way. Hawley is not that. How successful do you think he is likely to be to, kind of start steering this, broken down old pickup truck that is the Republican Party?
For a guy who so clearly hates TikTok and Instagram, Hawley wants to be an influencer, right? That's what he wants to be, is somebody who the Republican Party will follow. And maybe he'll run for president, maybe he won't. He currently says he has no plans to run in 2024. I think that might even be true. But he wants to be somebody who is outlining the vision for what the Republican Party should be. He wants to be a kingmaker and a power broker. And
does he have a vision for a future, for an America that, that allows video games or allows entertainment or allows international commerce, both and people crossing borders?
I think he's certainly open to international commerce, so long as American jobs are taken care of. And it's just and I mean that in a sort of serious way, but also in a not serious way, right? His priority is American workers, and international commerce is great so long as he feels like the American workers who he represents have been dealt with, and up until, have been taken care of. And what does taken care of mean? I don't know. I don't think he knows. I don't think the workers necessarily know. You know, one definition might be that you sometimes hear from these folks is that they would like to see it be easier for non-college graduates to raise a family and own a home on a single salary, right? So a male breadwinner, they would like male breadwinner families to have an easier time, especially when the male breadwinner does not have a college degree. And so that's, you know, maybe one definition of it. But I don't think it's so much that he wants no international trade. It's that he wants to deprioritize it relative to American workers. The problem is that when you deprioritize international trade, it's bad for everyone, right? And there are just huge, huge consumer costs that he is kind of not concerned about.
It's also fascinating when you think of that return. And, you know, I want to get to a discussion of him vis-a-vis somebody like Elizabeth Warren, but Elizabeth Warren has also talked about, you know, the horrors of two-income households, you know, mandatory two-income households. And there's always this weird moment where it's like, well, fuck, you know, maybe women want to work. You know, maybe work is fulfilling for women as it is for men or mothers, and that it's actually a choice. But let's hold that in abeyance for a second. You talk about how Hawley has an interest in somebody like Teddy Roosevelt, or that he resembles Teddy Roosevelt. Again, a Republican, the trust buster, not afraid to go after big combines that he found offensive to his sensibilities or economic understanding. What is it that Hawley in particular is pulling out of Teddy Roosevelt, and why is Teddy Roosevelt one of the worst presidents we've ever had?
So Hawley wrote a book about Teddy Roosevelt, and in some ways you could say Hawley came out of it not a fan, because he calls Roosevelt racist and statist. But he also, like in the same paragraph, says, but maybe there's something that we could sort of learn from his tradition and his worldview. And Roosevelt was a turn-of-the-century Republican progressive who was skeptical of modernity and big corporations, who championed antitrust, wasn't quite so much a sort of user of aggressive antitrust, so much as somebody who just wielded it as a threat against big corporations to try and get those corporations to do what he wanted. Hawley isn't exactly a Rooseveltian, right? That's not precisely what he is. But I definitely think he exists sort of in the tradition of of that early progressive movement in certain ways, right? He has this inherent skepticism of bigness, whether it's in some ways government. There's ways in which he is sort of nominally skeptical of massive government power and consolidation, but in most cases it means his skepticism of bigness expresses itself as an opposition to large corporations. He just constantly makes the argument that they have too much power over the daily lives of ordinary Americans, which he typically means, you know, middle class, middle of the country, you know, sort of families who are the type of, you know, Republicans in Missouri. He's certainly influenced by that, yeah, by that, yeah, sort of thinking, but I don't think it's necessarily. He both is and isn't a Rooseveltian. He is somebody who sort of has paid a lot of attention to the progressives, but he's updating it in some ways. And I think, you know, that's because of Donald Trump. And so he's taking, right, there's, how do I say this? Maybe the way to say it is that Hawley's progressivism is more performative and more about grandstanding than a lot of his predecessors. And it's not just about sort of saying the thing and, and even passing the policy. It's about making a show of it. And that, you know, was one of the things that really stood out to me as I was writing this, was just how much of Hawley's political persona amounts to actually kind of meaningless grandstanding.
Of course, he most famously grandstanded right before the riot in the Capitol on January 6th. Do you think that, is that something that actually will haunt him, or, you know, was that, or have we already forgotten the particulars of anything related to that?
I think to some extent it will. I mean, you've seen at least one big donor kind of denounce him, you know, people who have backed his political campaigns. And so there's a class of Republican or conservative who Hawley might have been more friendly or more directly connected with that is going to reject him at the same time. There are a lot of Republican voters who don't fully accept, what I think is the truth of what happened that day and sort of the surrounding events with regards to the election, right? Who there's a great skepticism amongst Republican voters right now that Biden actually fairly won the election. There are any number of Republicans who think that the attack on the Capitol was, if not a false flag operation, then at least partially, sort of an Antifa operation. And it just wasn't any of those things. I think it may be a little more complicated in some ways than every single person there was just a Trump MAGA head who had exactly one and only one clear and cognizable motivation. But it's pretty clear what they were there for and why. And all those Trump flags that were being carried and wielded, that wasn't an accident. That wasn't a mistake. It wasn't something that doesn't tell us anything.
Do you think, one of the things to kind of consider with somebody like Teddy Roosevelt, apart from his specific policy proposals and whatnot, he did kind of usher in a period of a new consensus, broadly speaking, of progressivism, where a government, a muscular federal government, one run by experts and authorities, kind of took over. You saw that last at least through Woodrow Wilson. It became a backdrop for American politics that ended what political scientists call the era of no decision. Does the fact that that Hawley and there are other populist style people in the Republican Party, not through tone, not through specific policies, although they overlap with people like Elizabeth Warren, with AOC, with Bernie Sanders, and to some degree with Joe Biden, where they're, is this how we are going to resolve our current era of no decision, where every couple of years, the House or the Senate or the White House or some, combination of those flip in a different way? We are spending just unimaginable amounts of money, which implies, if not dictates, government control of more aspects of the government. We are seeing more and more, Elizabeth Warren wants to get rid of Section 230. Josh Hawley wants to get rid of Section 230. People want to control social media. Democrats don't believe that Trump won the 2016 election fairly. They'll still talk about Russia, and whatnot. And then, Republicans, it's pretty shocking that the percentages that won't accept the idea that Joe Biden actually won. Is this the future for the next few years, a kind of populist moment that, comes with massive amounts of government spending and a lot of bellowing, a lot of performative work, as well as more money being pumped out to more people, which is kind of one of the definitions of populism. Populists never really want, you don't see a lot of populists saying, I'm going to shrink the size, scope, and spending of government, and I'm going to let you have control back over your lives. It's like, I'm going to give you lots of money, and I'm going to stop people who you find annoying from living.
Is this the populist moment? Well, I'm pretty comfortable saying it's not the libertarian moment.
Well, you're wrong about that, but right? It's always the libertarian moment.
There is certainly a nascent and overlapping populism in both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. They're not exactly the same, but they share some characteristics. It's notable that Hawley has teamed up with Democratic lawmakers to go after big tech on antitrust grounds in some cases, as well as with Bernie Sanders to push for bigger stimulus checks. When Democrats were negotiating this recent stimulus package, they actually lowered the cutoff threshold for the $1,400 checks to couples making up to $160,000 a year, right? And so it had been a little bit higher. And Hawley, in response, tweets something like, I'm upset because Democrats can find money for all this other stuff, but they, here's the quote, for billions for blue state bailouts, but they continue to water down direct relief to working people. And Hawley is a big government guy in a lot of ways, which is interesting given his sort of general skepticism of bigness. It's not that he is just, I think he's a qualified big government guy in certain ways, right? In theory, he doesn't like a lot of micromanagement from the government, but he doesn't mind bigness on its own. And he's just going to be one of the forces that is pushing not just Republican politics, but politics generally to the left on economics. And I think Hawley is about 40 or 41 years old. I might be a year or two off there, but he comes from a younger right-wing political tradition that has for the last 10 or 15 years been saying that the underserved demographic ideologically in American politics is people who are basically the opposite of libertarians, social conservatives who are not very concerned about limited government. And that's Hawley. He is a social conservative who is not very concerned about limited government.
The worst quadrant. Yeah, economic liberals and social conservatives. This is, it's kind of a nightmare. Scenario out however many more days, weeks, months Joe Biden has before he is declared unfit and Britney Spears' father becomes his conservator and takes over the government. But because as it stands, in a way, Hawley, he's making a play and people like him in the Republican Party are making a play for the future of that party, which I was joking before when I said, it's a decrepit jalopy. It's actually, it did relatively well in many ways in the 2020 elections, and it's poised to do pretty well in the midterms, assuming a variety of historical patterns. But the government right now is in control of big government Democrats. Certain elements of the Republican Party help that along, because a lot of Republicans love child tax credits, and it's going to be really hard for them to kind of be like, oh yeah, I don't want to give people, more money for more kids or anything like that. What do you think? Where does this go next? Joe Biden, the Washington Post said, when he was running, he was, as a nominee, he was the most liberal nominee who has ever run for president, leader of a party. He's kind of delivering on that. The $1.9 trillion, this is not his signature achievement. This is the down payment on something else. Where do you think it goes? And is there any stopping, this kind of metastatic growth of government over the next couple of years, months, whatever?
It's hard to remember now, but less than 30 years ago, Bill Clinton, in a State of the Union speech, said the era of big government is over. And this was a Democratic president who then went on, I believe this was right before, he went on to negotiate a reform to what was then referred to as welfare, and now is the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, that dramatically reduced welfare rolls and got many more people working, right? And that was viewed as a success. Bill Clinton wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about a decade after welfare reform went into place and said, this worked. This was a good idea. And the evidence he gave was that welfare rolls were smaller. And there's been a big movement against that idea on the left and in the Democratic policy apparatus over the last 20 years. The Democratic policy world has come to view welfare reform as a problem specifically because welfare rolls got smaller. And so we are going to see over the next 10 years or so, a Democratic party that thinks of itself as their goal is to ensure that more and more people are living on, relying on getting government assistance. And
they're being Ray Liotta'd, right? The government is coming around on a regular basis and putting a 10 or a 20 in their pocket.
And we're already starting to see that with things like the expansion of the child tax credit, the expansions of Obamacare, all of these checks that are going out to people. But the other thing is, we're going to see a comparable, not exactly the same, but a comparable movement on the right. And Josh Hawley is part of that. And Mitt Romney is part of that. Mitt Romney has proposed a permanent expansion of the child tax credit that in some ways is more generous than Joe Biden's. It does, I will say, in Mitt Romney's like a small defense of Mitt Romney's plan is that it rolls up a bunch of other spending, including temporary assistance for needy families and the SALT deduction in order to pay for this. So at least it is, in theory, deficit neutral. It's not being paid for via deficit spending or via it's a new tax in that it undoes a bad tax deduction that mostly benefits mid to high earning blue state folks, the SALT deduction. But it's similar sort of in directionally, right? And so I think we are going to see a Republican Party and a Democratic Party that just sort of have given up on that kind of Clintonian ideal of big government being over and of the internet and tech providing a glorious future for us in which we can figure out what we want to do with our own lives. They want people to be reliant on government, and they want government to be the backstop for a huge amount of American life.
And I guess, you know, one of the other things is that the restraint, you know, the kind of longstanding belief that government could not just keep spending more and more money, regardless of revenue, that seems to have disappeared. You know, and again, you can point to, you know, the line that everybody points to justify why deficit spending isn't a problem is Dick Cheney saying deficits don't matter. Reagan proved that early on in the Bush years, but there, you know, Clinton was a budget hawk. He at least cared. He was constrained by, you know, spending.
And even President Obama ran on George Bush's deficits are too big. He argued, you know, he would say flatly, Medicare and Medicaid spending are the biggest drivers of the long-term deficit. He presided over, you know, the Super Committee 1 and Super Committee 2. Now, he ignored their recommendations.
Right.
He didn't follow through on that stuff, but he and Democrats of the time, when they passed Obamacare, they went through all of these motions to make sure that at least on paper, it was going to be deficit neutral, right? So that some of it was paid for through some spending cuts and some of it was paid for through some tax hikes, right? And that idea has just gone totally out the door in the Democratic Party. And it's increasingly it's not increasingly on the way out. It is totally gone in the Republican Party too. And to whatever extent it existed before, which is to say that in many ways, it wasn't a real commitment. It was a kind of nominal commitment, right? Under George W. Bush passed Medicare Part D without paying for it, right? The deficits just ran up like crazy under George W. Bush. Like I said, to the point where Democrats were saying, hey, the Republicans are being irresponsible with the federal budget.
Nancy Pelosi, when she became...
There was a nominal commitment to it, right?
She was a deficit hawk at a certain point. Yeah.
And under Trump, that hypothetical commitment to responsible budget has just gone completely away.
So let's close out by talking about, obviously this is the libertarian moment. In the future, it'll be even more the libertarian moment. Seriously, what are the ways?
Right here on this podcast, we are having the libertarian moment between us.
You know, it's real and it's spectacular. What are the things that, in other aspects, there are many kind of things that are shifting in a libertarian direction. I think criminal justice reform, the end of the drug war, school choice is getting a better hearing than it has ever gotten, partly because of, the pandemic and the failure of school districts to really respond with anything other than give me more money and more time off. So, there's a lot of libertarian elements in the air that are, positions that are kind of gaining ground or being discussed. When it comes to things like budget and government spending, do you have any ideas about what might generate people to stop and say, you know what, it's just not a really, it's not a feasible idea that the government should be spending all of this money and controlling the, more and more of our lives through that spending, and that we can't afford it. Is, you know, how do we build back to a, or how do we build forward to a world in which people take the idea that you can't just have a government that continues to grow and grow and grow and not end up in a really bad place?
That's right. It's Joe Biden who wants to build back, right? Build back better. I think, you know, one possible answer is that there might be forcing mechanisms in the form of fiscal crises. You know, one of the main Medicare trust funds is set to be insolvent by 2026. That's not very far off. And and we're the next presidential race is whoever wins it is going to have to deal with that. And maybe they just won't talk about it during the presidential race because nobody cares anymore. But that's going to be an issue, and Congress and the White House are going to have to deal with that somehow or another. Now, it may just be something that they gloss over, it gets covered for a couple of weeks, and there's a bailout. And like, I think that's that's definitely a possibility.
I mean, that's obviously the odds on favorite is that we get close to something and then just fix it at the last moment worst possible way.
I also look at things like the exodus from California. And we talked about California being a high tax state, and a bunch of it is just tax related, right? It's not about, not necessarily about spending. It might be to some extent about regulation though. California is not a super business friendly state, despite the fact that it has a lot of big successful businesses and startups located there. And there are businesses and business owners, especially now in the our Zoomified world in which geography matters less and less than it ever has before, in which people who are starting businesses are not just going to say, are going to be less likely to say, hey, I want to go to San Francisco and be there because I need to be there to be around the people who have the money, to be around the talent. The talent may be
people
everywhere.
People have the ideas,
And maybe they're just going to go locate themselves in Austin or Miami, which are interesting cities in their own right, and which may provide better regulatory environments. And so when there is policy competition, as we see between the states, that can spur movement, maybe not big revolutions, but change over time if places like New York and California are forced to change to compete with Texas and Florida.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine, check out his cover story. Josh Hawley's Toxic Populism, which is also about the Republican Party, and read his stuff about budget and finance issues at Reason.com, because he's covering the American Recovery Act with, I think you're spending a little too much time on that. It can't be good for you to actually be following the ways in which $1.9 trillion gets spent.
Somebody's got to do it, Nick. It's a hard job, but
okay. Well, thank you for taking.
Taking
a bullet for the rest of us. But Peter, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.